the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network presents Vatican Insider with Joan Lewis. Each week, Joan brings you news from inside the Vatican and the Church around the world, as well as interviews and answers to your questions. Now, here's the host of Vatican Insider, Joan Lewis.
Welcome to Vatican Insider on a wonderful busy weekend for Pope Leo at the end of a busy week. The news summaries will be a bit shorter than usual this week due to the length of the interview segment, part two of my conversation with Monsignor Roger Landry, as he looks back at his work at the Holy See Mission to the United Nations, his time as chaplain at Columbia University, and then to aid to the Church in Need, and his appointment by Pope Francis as a missionary of mercy, an amazing, multifaceted life. First, a look at the top news stories. Stories that feature a Pope of surprises. And this will probably become a nickname for Leo XIV. Sunday, May 25th, a very big day for the Holy Father. In his first Regina Caeli address from the window of the papal study in the Apostolic Palace, Pope Leo said, "Just a few days ago I began my ministry among you, and first of all I want to thank you for the affection you are showing me while I ask you to support me with your prayers and closeness." His reflections focused on the day's gospel, followed by the Regina Caeli prayer that, once again, he sang. In the afternoon, as he traveled to St. John Lateran to take possession of his cathedra, his see, as Bishop of Rome, Leo stopped at Rome's Capitoline Hill, the seat of the city's civic and democratic administration, where he was greeted by the mayor. He thanked him and the civil authorities present for their warm welcome. Paraphrasing St. Augustine, Pope Leo told the people of Rome, "Today I can say that for you and with you I am Roman." Saying, "I offer you the little that I have and am," Pope Leo celebrated the first Mass at the Papal Basilica of St. John Lateran and greeted his new diocesan family. After Mass, he went to the Basilica of St. Mary Major, where he venerated the icon of Mary, Salus Populi Romani. He prayed before the tomb of Pope Francis, and he urged Christians to grow in devotion to Mary. Before returning to the Vatican, the Holy Father stepped out onto the Basilica's loggia to greet the faithful gathered outside, extending peace to everyone and expressing his gratitude for their presence. Monday, May 26th. In the morning, there was a joyful encounter between the Holy Father and the football team from Naples that on Friday had won its fourth Italian national championship. Stressing the moral quality of sport, Pope Leo XIV told the players, "It's the team, not the individual players, which wins a championship." Before reading his address, however, the Pope joked with the players, suggesting that they hadn't wanted to applaud him because the press had reported he was a fan of the Roma team. Monday afternoon, as pilgrims and representatives of the African continent, including ambassadors accredited to the Holy See, celebrated Mass in St. Peter's Basilica, Pope Leo XIV made a surprise visit, and he invited everyone to live the faith as a sign of hope in our world. He even took a photo sitting in the midst of that special group. Wednesday, May 28th. Reflecting on the parable of the Good Samaritan at the weekly general audience, Pope Leo XIV challenged everyone not to let busy lives prevent us from feeling compassion towards others. On a journey, he said, a man is beaten, robbed, and left for dead, which can happen to us when circumstances, people, even those we've trusted, strip us of everything and leave us out in the open. But it's in such encounters with others that we come to know who we really are. When we meet someone in need, we are faced with a choice: to care for them or look the other way. The Samaritan helps, not out of a religious requirement, but because he is one human being in front of another human being in need. Compassion, said Leo, is a matter of humanity, not a religious issue. At the end of the audience, Leo XIV appealed for a ceasefire now in Gaza. He said, from the Gaza Strip, we hear rising ever more insistently to the heavens the cries of mothers and fathers who clutch at the lifeless bodies of their children and who are continually forced to move about in search of a little food and water and safer shelter from the bombardments. Also Wednesday, Pope Leo XIV sent a telegram to Cardinal Jaime Spengler, Archbishop of Porto Alegre, and President of CELAM, the Latin American and Caribbean Episcopal Council, in which he warmly greeted the bishops as they gather for the 40th Ordinary General Assembly of CELAM, marking 70 years since the first General Conference of the Episcopate was held in Rio de Janeiro in 1955. Thursday, May 29th, Pope Leo made a surprise trip to Castel Gandolfo, where he visited the Borgo Laudato Si, an area of the papal residence converted by Pope Francis into a space for formation and raising awareness about the care for our common home. Leo also visited the papal palace, once a summer papal residence that Francis turned into a museum in 2016. He also spent time in the beautiful Garden of the Virgin Mary, the Belvedere Gardens, and the Crypto Porticus, the archaeological remains of the Roman Emperor Domitian's audience hall. Friday, May 30th, the Holy Father had a series of private audiences, including Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople, Bartholomew I. He also welcomed members of the movements and associations of the Arena of Peace. A year ago, he said, you launched the great Arena of Peace event in Verona with Pope Francis in attendance. He said at that time, building peace starts by standing alongside victims and seeing things from their point of view. This approach is essential for disarming hearts, approaches, and mentalities, and for denouncing the injustices of a system that kills and is based on the throwaway culture. Those are the week's news highlights, but now stay here for a riveting conversation with Monsignor Roger Landry as he explains some of his ministries as a priest.
Proclaiming the faith, changing lives.
The year was 2005. EWTN begins celebrating 25 years with its first family celebration in Denver, Colorado. Attendees will hear renowned speakers and can visit with the network's hosts and well-known Catholic authors.
To learn more about Mother Angelica's life and the history of EWTN, visit EWTN.com/Mother Angelica.
Hello, friends. This is Deacon Charlie Echeverry from the Living the Call podcast, and I want to share with you a bit about why we need to go to confession. Reconciliation is our moment to speak to Christ honestly about our shortcomings. Confession is cathartic. It cleanses, it renews, and it strengthens all at the same time. If you haven't been to confession in a while, that's okay, but now might be that moment that God is calling you to come to Him and receive the grace of His mercy in the sacrament of reconciliation.
People often wonder about the power of prayer. Why do we pray anyway if we end up having to do so much work for ourselves? So the reality is, we find ourselves up against a wall, and we pray. It's like God turns a light up on the other side of that wall, brighter and brighter and brighter, until the light shines through the tiniest cracks. God might not do it all for me, but He shows me how to make my work more efficient, so that together we can accomplish all things through His grace.
Welcome back to Vatican Insider. Here's Joan Lewis.
Welcome back to my conversation with Monsignor Roger Landry. In part one last week, we looked at the election of our new Pope Leo XIV. This week, Monsignor looks at his work at the Holy See Mission to the UN, his time as chaplain at Columbia University, and then for aid to the Church in Need, and then his appointment by Pope Francis as a missionary of mercy. I do want to go on right now because there is so much to your life before Leo XIV. Just on the time frame, going back to your years 2015 to 2022, and oh my gosh, at the beginning of COVID, 2020, remember there was supposed to be the big talk at the United Nations 25 years after Beijing on women, and I flew into New York and to talk, and the UN had to downsize everything, but we had some wonderful times. But talk about the importance of, I don't think a lot of people really have this mission to the UN in the back of their minds.
So the Holy See, the joke goes, is the third biggest country in the world.
Yeah.
to now India and China in that order, because we represent 1.4 billion people, but we're the only ones with a truly global footprint. When Paul VI came to the United Nations in 1965, he said, "The United Nations aspires to do at a political and diplomatic level what the church has always done at a human level, serve all people everywhere." So the church takes what happens at the United Nations seriously. Every time a pope's come to the United Nations, they've spoken very clearly that the UN has to be reformed.
Yeah.
There are lots of processes that are not adequate to the needs that are out there,
sure,
and the hopes that people are placing the UN. There's corruption in various of the UN agencies. People know that. But they said, if the UN didn't exist, we would have to found it, because we've got to have,
sure,
some means by which we can settle one-on-one disputes without resorting to war.
Yeah.
Certain of the problems in development transcend individual countries' foreign aid capacities. There needs to be some type of organization.
Sure.
If we're genuinely going to protect things like our environment from pollution of waters and air, you need to have a forum in which you can come to these international,
absolutely,
accords. And then the popes have always insisted that we've got to have some mechanism by which people keep their agreements. And so from the 5th century onward, the church has had this principle of pacta sunt servanda, that treaties need to be kept. And I've just gone through with you the four main pillars of the United Nations Charter.
Sure.
Preventing war, the church has been doing that since Jesus said, "Blessed are the peacemakers," and arrived as the Prince of Peace. Protecting human rights and the dignity on which it's based. I mean, that's our day-to-day social teaching in action. To keep our word, and so we don't lie,
yeah,
and that's one of the reasons why even Muslim dictators want to surround themselves by Catholics, because the end doesn't justify the means, and we tell the truth. And then finally, lifting the poor out of poverty.
Sure.
And that's always been a goal of the church. And so the Holy See helps the international community keep our eyes on these human goods,
absolutely,
rather than just letting everything drop to national interest, to selfishness, to self-centeredness. And so it was a real honor to work there for 7 years for Pope Francis.
Well, and the things that people want to know about a lot of the topics you've just mentioned, they go to the website and they can see our speeches. They can even see in some instances, you know, a summary of it. But one thing, I was on four delegations that John Paul named me to in the 90s. And I can remember, it was either Cairo or Beijing, at a big press conference that Navarro Valls gave. Very talented head of the press, mm-hmm, office. One journalist stood up and said, "What right do you even have to be here?" And Navarro Valls said, "Well, interestingly enough," he said, "actually, probably the oldest diplomatic corps in the world is the Catholic Church, the Holy See." He said, we're out there in the 200s and 300s, 400, sending emissaries to different countries.
Gregory the Great was an apocrisarius in the 600s. He was what we would now call a nuncio, the messenger of the Holy Father,
yeah,
to the court in Constantinople. And the Holy See now has 184 bilateral relations,
exactly,
with different countries. There are a few communist countries and a few,
yeah,
Muslim countries that are theocracies that don't have diplomatic,
sure,
relations. We're almost right behind the United States of America in terms of diplomatic relations. So anybody wants to charge that, it's just, what's wrong with almost every country in the world except communist countries,
yeah,
and Muslim dictatorships, that they all want to enter into diplomatic relationships with the Holy See? Many people, including Catholics, don't know that the Pope is likewise a head of state.
Yes, yeah.
That the Holy See is a state in the international community. Historically, it was powerful and influential state when it was tied to, for example, the papal city states in,
sure,
central Italy. But it still maintains that service to the international community that we have a right, the Pope has a right as an international leader, as a monarch, to participate in those debates. Nobody complains about Nauru with its 11,000 citizens.
Sure.
There are several countries at the UN which have fewer than 25,000, and we never hear anybody really complain about that. The opposition to the Holy See is always because of what we stand for, not because we're standing.
And what's interesting, the world's media, do they want to know what the Holy See says? Because when I was on those delegations, The UN had its press conference every day. The only other country, institution there, that had a press conference every day was the Holy See. We had so much to say. I mean, Navarro-Valls had several languages, beautifully expressive, did such a wonderful job. But, I mean, there weren't rooms big enough because all of the media wanted to be there. We would have cameramen standing on the desks that we were working at to be able to get their good pictures.
We always were sought to be on the side of the countries who wanted to win.
Sure.
At the United Nations. We weren't always on the same sides of the same countries. It depended on the issue. But any time the Holy See was on a country's side as part of a coalition pushing for a particular outcome, they were always grateful because we brought premises to the conclusions that nobody else would synthesize to give. Most of their premises were not on values. Most of them were in terms of national desires.
Well, we had people who linguistically could speak to someone else in their own language. It could be Arabic or Chinese or French. And that makes a huge difference.
Most diplomats have more than one language, but most Holy See diplomats have served in so many different countries that by the time we show up there, we can have native conversations in 4, 5, 6 different languages. And especially the smaller countries are so grateful when we make the effort to allow them to be themselves. That's part of the art of effective diplomacy, and the Holy See's diplomatic corps has a high reputation for that reason.
Well, sometimes people go to these conferences and the documents at the UN will be in English, and the first language of a lot of people is not English. I can remember in Beijing that we would help people translate. So you'd have, here was the thing I thought was beautiful. There were so many other diplomats, heads of delegations, etc., members, who wanted to talk to the Holy See. The Holy See never went to their office. They always had to come to ours. And 9 times out of 10, we were helpful in the sense that paragraph 8.25 of a certain document in English, they wanted to be able to say it with the correct translation in French or in some other language. And you know what, Roger? 22 people on our delegation in Beijing, 13 countries, we had 9 languages, including Arabic and Chinese.
And Catholics should be proud of this. What the Holy See Diplomatic Corps does is it tries to take the light of Catholic social teaching to the questions, to the problems, to the crises that the church is facing. And so we have a bimillennial prep for these types of things, rather than just what the platform of the particular party that won the last election says.
Sure.
And so people really do appreciate that, and I was honored for those 7 years to play a small part in it.
The last of those years was 2022, and then next on your resume, Catholic chaplain at Columbia University. A pastor, a chaplain, being around young people, because I love it, and I could be their grandmother, but being around young people can be so stimulating. It can be challenging. I just think of the young people who might have fallen away from their faith. You were there for them. Certainly, possibly conversions, who knows. So talk a little bit about that time.
What young people on college campuses want the most today is they really want strong leadership. They want somebody to be a spiritual father as a priest. They don't want a groovy older brother who'll basically let them do whatever they want. They want to know the why behind the what. Even if initially they don't necessarily agree with it, even if initially they're going to struggle to live by church teaching, they want to hear it because there are so many panderers out there who'll just tell them whatever they want to hear that they've got a real hunger for the truth, and so they will listen. I was pleasantly surprised at how hungry they were for what has always been on the church's menu. And so when they were getting it, they were coming back for more. They were asking for seconds. My last semester there was last fall. And in the fall, I used to do 2 OCIA, Order of Christian Initiation adult programs, each year because I didn't want people whose last semester was going to be, for example, in the fall, not to be able to be received into the church because they weren't going to be around at Easter time. And so it was a lot more work on me, but they were students who could study And you could do concentrated courses, just like you might have in a language or in one of the fields there. We did the same thing in the faith. My last semester there, we had 36 students in this program.
Aww.
And that's a sign of just the explosion of young people interested in the faith all across the country. Lots of people in lots of dioceses and parishes are reporting records. God's doing something beautiful among people. God the Father's continuing to draw. What we need to give them is straight meat and potatoes. That's what they've been made to hunger for. And sometimes we want to soften Jesus' message.
Yeah.
But Jesus challenged us.
Doesn't
he said,
work.
If we're going to be his follower, we have to deny ourselves, pick up our cross each day and follow him. Forgive 70 times 7 times. That we need to go to the second mile, give our outer garments, not just our inner garments. Pluck out our eyes and chop off our hands and feet if they're leading us to sin. As John Paul II said in Holland back in 1985 or 86, you know, Jesus gives us a challenging gospel, but he also gives us himself to meet those challenges.
Exactly.
And so this is the crucified guy we've signed up to follow. And so when you give young people that message in a culture that's just saying, if it feels good, do it.
Yeah.
When you give it to them, they're coming on in because they, especially at Columbia, and so they really want to do something for God and for others. And when the church challenges them, then they're not going to respond to the challenges of groups like Planned Parenthood or
they'll
the Human Rights Campaign or things like this. We've got to challenge them with the challenge that comes from the Lord. That's what I learned from St. John Paul II when I was a young person, and what a great joy it was for me to be a vujek for them, an uncle who could accompany them more and more toward Christ, who is the truth, who has the answer to what every human heart asks.
Well, and the more often focus does so many wonderful things to Federation of Catholic University Students.
And we had Focus at Columbia, and they were my chief collaborators, and I'm so grateful to have had these missionaries at my side.
Now, at the same time you were at Columbia, you were also the Ecclesiastical Assistant to Aid to the Church in Need USA. That's an amazing organization.
Yeah, it was a Vatican appointment. I had worked with Aid to the Church in Need for various events at the United Nations. Among my many duties for the Holy See was to run 25 conferences a year. And two times a year on average, we would have a focus on persecuted Christians across the globe, because if we weren't talking about them, much in the media would just easily ignore them.
Sure.
And so we would bring some of the victims from Africa, from Asia, from Latin America, and some of the disputes down there with, for example, the FARC in Colombia or Venezuela, you name it, some of the indigenous groups who were likewise suffering, would bring them and host these events, which were super well attended and got traction after.
And this is born in Europe.
So Aid to the Church in Need was born by Father Werner Fried von Straten, who after World War II, because people were starving to death behind the Iron Curtain, would just ask people for bacon, and he would bring the bacon to the starving masses. And then he started to raise some money in order to be able to care for the brothers and sisters who were suffering. And because as the media became bigger, you started to see much more readily where and how Christians are suffering. Aid to the Church in Need just grew. And so it was a tremendous honor for me for a few years to be the national chaplain in the United States, what's called ecclesiastical assistant in Vatican parlance, in order to spiritually accompany the staff, give a real spiritual focus to everything we were doing. Sure, we had to raise money in order to be able to help the persecuted Christians across the globe. But we were far more than a fundraising organization, because we were doing it out of love for God and love for our brothers and sisters. And so that's one of the big roles of the ecclesiastical assistant. And I learned a ton about the particular sufferings in lots of areas, meeting with the bishops who would come to the United States, meeting with some of the persecuted. Little did I know at the time that that was going to be preparing me for the position that I now have as the National Director of the Pontifical Mission Societies. But the scope that I got, looking at all 195 countries at the UN, the scope that I got from looking at the particular sufferings of the Christians, particularly Asia, Africa, and Central and Eastern Europe, that has equipped me very well now to lead the Pontifical Mission Societies in the United States. in helping those who are trying to live by the faith and spread it in these places do so.
Something I should have done, I've done earlier, but I always get so carried away in a conversation with a guest, I forget we're like doing a radio show. I should have said even a few minutes ago, if you've just tuned in, I have been speaking with Monsignor Roger Landry, currently National Director of the Pontifical Mission Societies in the United States, but we have been looking back a bit at his life and the amazing time here in Rome, the history, the joy, the hope, the enthusiasm that has greeted our new Pope. Give us a little word, though, because I know you love this, and frankly, I do, too. Being a missionary of mercy set up by Pope Francis during the Jubilee of Mercy, extraordinary.
It's the great honor of my life, to be blunt, after being a priest. I've said many times that on my tombstone, it will give my name, and then it will say Missionarius Misericordia, missionary of mercy, because that's all I've really aspired to be. I think that that's what the priesthood is, a missionary of the merciful love of God. And so back in the Jubilee of Mercy in 2015-2016, called by Pope Francis, he named 1,100 of the 410,000 priests in the world missionaries of mercy, and he gave us a threefold commission.
Yeah.
First, he gave us his ability in the sacrament of confession. There are certain sins that are restricted to the Holy Father because they're also crimes. If you desecrate the Holy Eucharist, if a priest violates the seal of confession or seeks sexual favors or tries to absolve an accomplice in sin, or if somebody illicitly tries to ordain a bishop, or if somebody tries physically to attack the Holy Father, or tape a confession and put it out on some type of media.
Right.
All of these are crimes that you can't be forgiven by an ordinary priest, except on danger of death, because the Holy See takes it so seriously that you first need to come to the Holy See so that they're able to give the penance, even while maintaining the anonymity of the confessional.
Next week, in the final part of our conversation, Monsignor Landry tells us more about being a missionary of mercy and concludes by looking at his newest assignment as National Director of the Pontifical Mission Societies in the U.S.
For more information on these stories, or to check out Joan's blog and to ask her a question, go to EWTN.com. That's EWTN.com. Thanks for listening to Vatican Insider on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.